Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. We're talking today with Rebecca Edwards, professor of history at Vassar College, about her book entitled New Spirits, Americans in the Gilded Age, 1865 to 1905, published this year by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
Well, to begin, I know that book titles are often important to authors. A good title can serve as a kind of lens to help the reader mentally focus on and organize the text that follows. And my guess is that you took a bit of care in coming up with your title, New Spirits.
I tried to. I feel like this is the era that's the dumping ground in U.S. history. It's where all the failed strikes and failed third political parties and all the sort of detritus of Reconstruction and things sort of get dumped. And so a lot of people have a very negative view of this period, and they really perhaps skipped this chapter in their high school history textbooks. And so New Spirits, I thought, kind of framed it to think more as Americans did at that time, coming out of the Civil War, coming out of Union victory, coming out of emancipation, and really having a lot of hope for a very different future.
You took the title from Walt Whitman's book, Democratic Vistas, published in 1871. And Whitman seems to be a kind of spirit that presides over your whole book. And you talk in the book about how, for Whitman, democracy is a cultural as well as a political project. And there's a quote that you include in your introduction that you take from Democratic Vistas that expresses Whitman's notion of democracy, and I thought I might read it.
Sure.
Did you too, O friend, suppose democracy was only for elections, for politics, and for a party name? I say democracy is only of use there that it may pass on and come to its flower and fruits in religion, literature, colleges, and schools, democracy in all public and private life.
I would love to think that Whitman is a sort of presiding spirit over the book. That's a wonderful idea. And I think he did have this very expansive notion of democracy. And in many ways, Whitman is much more famous in the 20th century than he was in the 19th century. But I think in this particular very optimistic vision of America's individualism and its energy and its promise, he really tapped into something that was quite widespread.
In Democratic Vistas, he stresses the way the broadening of trade and communication might help work for the public good, does he? And he also saw the benefits of racial and ethnic pluralism for this democracy.
Yes, and in fact, he was someone who predicted that eventually not only would blacks vote, but black men vote, but that women would get the vote. He sort of said within a generation, he thought, women would also vote.
The term Gilded Age that you use in your subtitle is taken from Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner's book of the same title, and it's often used to caption this period. The term reflects a kind of cynicism and pessimism, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think that Twain might have said that he intended it more to be a critique of high society in Washington and political corruption, and maybe he wouldn't have meant it to apply to everybody in America. But I actually didn't want it in the subtitle because I really hate the term Gilded Age, but this period is so widely known as the Gilded Age that you really have to use it or no one knows which period you're talking about. There's my little crusade to try to get this era of American history called something else.
Yeah. Twain's central figures, including, of course, Tom Sawyer, are often con men. And to some extent, I think that's what the Gilded Age is about.
Yes, and actually the novel The Gilded Age has a great such character in it, Colonel Sanders, Colonel Mulberry Sanders, who's a sort of eternal go-getter and believer in all sorts of utopian schemes and mostly get-rich-quick schemes. And he's a great character.
The story of this period is often told as a litany of spectacular betrayals of Whitman's vision of democracy, which you do write about, and these include the disenfranchisement of African Americans, the ethnic cleansing and total displacement of the Native American population, the internal wars of incorporation, the often brutal economic and military conquests and occupations of Cuba, Hawaii, and the Philippines, not to mention many other forays into the Caribbean, Latin America, and even China. Or, biographically, it's also told as a kind of national coming-of-age story, which is how the period was presented to me, as I recall, in high school, or as a dialectic between capital and labor, greed and progressivism, etc. But you present the story in a different way.
I try to. I try to at least sort of complicate some of those views. Well, I think in some ways we're still sort of captives of Teddy Roosevelt, because he came along and sort of said, well, everything before me was corruption and darkness, and now the progressive era begins when I arrive. And I think that that was a peculiar way to think about the Gilded Age as being where all the bad stuff happens, and then Teddy Roosevelt shows up, and the progressive era, of course, has that very positive connotation. And I'd like to mix it up a little bit and suggest that, you know, that moment when disfranchisement happens and when imperialism really gets going, that that's not necessarily the beginnings of progressivism, but it might be more complicated.
Yeah. You balance the darker aspects of the period with more hopeful developments, not always covered in the general histories, generally speaking. And this hopefulness is tied in your book to an attention paid to ordinary people that conventional histories generally also overlook. Your story often includes a personal perspective, and I notice you frequently quote from letters, diaries, and other sources, often of ordinary people, as a matter of illustration, so that the book has a bit of a Ken Burns sensibility.
Walt Whitman and Ken Burns, that's very gracious. I think that there are some fields of history that have opened up recently. The two that come to mind right away are gay and lesbian history, history of sexuality, and also the history of environmentalism, you know, sort of thinking about the history of the environmental movement. And one of the nice things about writing a survey of this period for the first time in a while, because nobody's written a survey of this period for a little while, is being able to kind of incorporate those stories, which are really kind of hopeful stories that weren't there before. They just, you know, weren't really, those stories weren't there in the 1960s.
These stories often do involve people who aren't prominent in the usual historical pantheon. The stories of ordinary people doing ordinary things that become extraordinary and heroic in perspective.
This is a good era to ignore the presidents a little bit, because nobody can remember the Gilded Age presidents anyway. And I think there's a certain amount of attention to policy definitely needs to be paid, but there's also this incredible richness of social experience that I wanted to capture a little bit.
Yeah. So two overarching perceptions occurred and recurred to me as I read through New Spirits. First, one is struck by how pivotal this period is for understanding our own time. That is, how often issues and conflicts that define the last half of the 19th century resonate with issues and events we experience today. The uglier politics and uses of religion and immigration are an old story, as well as the tried and true assaults on racial and ethnic groups for political ends. If J.P. Morgan was around today, I think he'd be CEO of Halliburton. And I wonder if you could comment on that. Do you, as you're watching current events, reflect on connections between your area of study and the world around you?
I do, and you know, with the recent election, I was just talking with my students this morning about political realignments and realigning elections, and is this one? And those are always really good questions to ask. One of the things that seems to me that we misunderstand about the Gilded Age is that it's traditionally thought of as a kind of laissez-faire era, and that there wasn't really any government around until the 20th century. And one of the things I wanted to suggest was that, in fact, government is quite powerful by 19th century standards. The federal government comes out of the Civil War with all kinds of new powers, and that it's actually the role of the federal government in both in economic policy and in the suppression of strikes and all kinds of different ways. Government power is a really critical, plays a critical role in this period, and it's more a question of how power is used or on whose behalf government power is used, rather than sort of this absence of government, which is often portrayed as the norm.
So with the rise of corporate capitalism, corporate interests were manipulating the government even back in the 1890s.
They were. It's a little hard to tell who's manipulating whom, since the party politicians are also very concerned about economic development. And I mean, they impose a steel tariff because they want to build a steel industry in the United States and not be dependent on overseas steel. So there's a little bit of back scratching going on both ways, I think.
Now you tell a nice story about Carnegie and Carnegie's people duping the Navy Department.
Yes, they, I think, considerably overcharged the U.S. government for the steel. There were special kinds of what they called Harveyized steel, nickel-plated steel that they were using in warships. In fact, government contracts got the Carnegie Steel Corporation through the Depression of the 1890s. And that kind of steady work was really important for some of these large corporations. And that's absent. There are whole documentaries about Homestead and the Homestead strike that never really note that the kind of steel that was being made at Homestead was designed exclusively for the Navy, and that the U.S. government was the only customer for that steel. So the government piece of that triangle between capital and labor and government is missing in a lot of our accounts of this era.
With regard to the way the nation responds to disaster, the recent political and, if you count Iraq, military reactions to the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon remind one of the rolling back of civil and human rights that followed the Great Depression of 1893, which, unlike the period that followed the collapse of the market in 1929 and even the riots that occurred in 1967, weren't followed by progressive reform and intelligent attempts to address the causes of these disasters, but by reactionary violence and a collective kind of willful ignorance on a massive scale, and much of the mass media of the 1890s was complicit in this.
I think the only thing I can say that is that I think that there was a positive reaction to a lot of the crises of the 1890s. It just took a while. It wasn't something that happened immediately. And one of the interesting things is that the political parties, like the populists that come along in the 1890s to really challenge the status quo, are resoundingly defeated. But then many of their proposals are adopted in the progressive era. And there's a lot of jokes about the populists having sprouted too early in the season and gotten frostbitten. Uh-huh. Or one of the populists said, well, this was kind of highway robbery. The people who defeated us then turned around and borrowed our proposals. But I think that there were the beginnings of a critique in the 1890s that really did flourish a decade or two decades later, but it just took a while for it to kind of emerge.
So you think these informed then the response to the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Roosevelt administration?
I think so, and in fact, I think there are direct parallels, even from some things during Reconstruction, as far back as the 1860s and 1870s, you could see the beginnings of some of the policies that would then inform the New Deal. And I wonder if by chopping up this era into little parts, we don't miss some of the broader continuities there, or at least some visions coming out of the Civil War era that ultimately culminate in the New Deal.
Yeah, interesting, because certainly one depression and the results of that depression would have informed what happened with the next depression, that something must have been learned, you'd think.
That's right. And the depressions of the 1870s and the 1890s were very severe, and it's clear that there's a shift toward understanding that unemployment during depressions is extremely unpredictable, and that it's not that people are lazy, but that they are structurally unemployed. And so you begin to have a discussion over the late 19th century about the terms of employment, the economy, public policy that begins to look quite modern.
As for the other overarching perception, I also couldn't help but think just how volatile a period this must have seemed for so many of the people who lived through it. And your book really brings this home. We like to think of our own time as a period of great change, driven for the most part by science and technology at a pace we often tell ourselves that humanity has never experienced before. But one could say, relatively speaking, that we have no idea what real change looks like compared to what people in this country experienced in the 40-year period covered by your book.
It certainly was a period of dramatic change. There's a book about the telegraph that's called The Victorian Internet, and I'm not sure whether I agree with the author that we should draw a sort of direct parallel between the telegraph and the internet. But it certainly is true that partly what's changing in the 19th century is systems of information, systems of transportation and communication that connect people in new ways, and a real revolution in the whole economy and society.
One statistic you cite that really brings us home for me is the change in the population of the city of Chicago between 1860 and 1900.
Chicago really doesn't exist before the Civil War in any reason.
It's the same size as Poughkeepsie, right? 30,000 people.
Exactly. It's just been a tiny town, and then on the eve of the Civil War, it's a sort of Poughkeepsie side. In fact, Poughkeepsie was bigger, I'm sure, on the eve of the Civil War at that time because it was a major industrial center. And then by 1900, it's got a million people, and there's an enormous metropolis. So
now, one of the metaphors you use to organize new spirits is that of fire, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things I wanted to get at in this period is that sense of destructive violence and transformation. And when I started thinking about fire, everything just kind of pulled together. One of the things that hampers our understanding of this period is that we see it as preceded by this incredibly dramatic civil war that was so bloody and so heroic, and then that everything sort of settled down afterwards and nothing happened. And instead, it seems to me that a lot of the Civil War is almost kind of a prelude to some of the even larger conflicts. I mean, one way you could think about it is that emancipation and the fight over labor in the South is part of a much broader discussion about what the relationship is going to be between capital and labor and the rise of wage labor, which isn't really accepted in the early 19th century as a legitimate way to spend your time. You might want to be a wage laborer for a little while, but what you most want to be is an independent artisan or merchant or businessman or farmer, or in some ways work for yourself. And it's over the course of the 19th century that people get used to the idea that most people are going to be working for somebody else.
Interesting.
That kind of came a long way from the issue of fire. But
you do talk about actual fire, though, also. I mean, apart from being a metaphor, that more people were actually killed by fire in a rather short period after the clear-cutting of the continent than were killed at the Battle of Antietam.
The casualties from the wildfires that burned in Peshtigo, Wisconsin, particularly in the Great Lakes areas, were just unbelievable. The number of people killed by railroads in this period is really extraordinary. And in some ways, those are sort of accepted costs, just like we sort of accept now that we're going to use automobiles no matter what, and the fatalities and the injuries that result are just sort of part of daily life. But if you start doing the math on it, you know, it's a tremendously dangerous form of technology.
It was a dangerous occupation, certainly being a brakeman on a railroad.
It was, and it was sometimes dangerous to be a passenger, and it was even more dangerous to be just a bystander, because they cut railroads through all these urban neighborhoods, usually poor neighborhoods, and the casualties among people who were in horse-drawn carriages and the horse was spooked and ran in front of the train, or children who were playing by the train tracks. I mean, it was just a tremendous, tremendous death rate from these trains coming through.
You also use Henry George's metaphor of the wedge from his Progress and Poverty, written 8 short years after Whitman's Democratic Vistas, which talks about the failed promise of especially the railroads.
Yes, and I think George was one of the first to say, you know, industrialization is not going to bring prosperity to everybody. Because I think a lot of people were so excited by what was going on in the 19th century that they said, hey, economic development, diversification of the economy, the growth of industry, the expansion into the West, this is tremendous. But George said, well, you know, the poverty that's being created is structural, and that's why he had this idea of a wedge, not that the rising tide was going to raise all boats, but that some people were going to become much richer and that there would be a great deal of prosperity, but there would also be people who were going to be, as he said, pushed down by this wedge of increasing industrialization.
And the wedge is still with us, obviously.
I think so. I mean, I think in many ways you can look back to this period and structurally see the emergence of many of the issues and problems and also positive aspects of our society and politics today.
Yeah. Well, for most of us who aren't historians, and I include educated people in these numbers, what we believe about the past often seems to me to be about 80% fable. Often, I suppose, because history is a matter of storytelling, and storytellers often have agendas to peddle. And one of the most egregious examples of this in terms of our national memory is the story of the great experimental program of Reconstruction that was attempted but ultimately defeated in the decade following the Civil War. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes, I could. I think that one of my struggles in this book was try to put Reconstruction into a national story, which is really reflecting the work of a wide array of scholars recently who have tried to say, look, it doesn't make sense to think of Reconstruction as something that happens in rural Louisiana. We have to think about this in a national sense. And, for example, it's their experience with labor conflict in the North and the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 that causes a lot of middle-class Northerners to say, you know, actually, it's not so much that we and the freedmen defeated the Confederates, it's that we and the ex-Confederates both have a labor problem, because here they are fighting these strikers in South Carolina or Mississippi or New Orleans, and here we are fighting these strikers in the North, and the working class needs to be more orderly. And so maybe we should let the people in the South who are in power determine what the social and economic order should be. And so you see a sort of shift to people really identifying with relatively elite affluent interests in both sections of the country.
Yeah, the story you tell, it illustrates the forces that Reconstruction was up against in microcosm, I thought, was the story of the Combahee strike in South Carolina, where labor essentially was pitted against large plantation interests that ultimately served not only to disenfranchise the workers, but to disenfranchise freedmen and freed women in general.
My history 276 class is reading that book now, the Eric Foner book about this strike. And what's so amazing about this moment is that there's this huge rice worker strike in South Carolina where the Reconstruction government has not yet been forcibly toppled. But in next door Georgia, redeemers, or so-called democratic redeemers, have really taken over the government by force. And so, strangely enough, there's no strike in Georgia. And so it's a very nice example of how that government piece of the triangle that we were talking about earlier, that none of these are really fights between capital and labor. There's always a government piece of the triangle in there that makes the difference.
Is there any truth, then, to the fable that we get, very much informed by Martha Mitchell, of course, and even Thomas Dixon, that depicts Reconstruction through the image of the carpetbagger and that is told like a 19th century melodrama about proud Southern people defending their land and their women against rapacious, corrupt Northerners? And this, of course, also has a racial element even today.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I would say this. I would say that in Reconstruction, one of the things that Reconstruction governments did in both the North and the South was use government in new ways. So, for example, in the South, a lot of Reconstruction governments, almost all Reconstruction governments, say, look, we're going to charge people taxes to have a public school system. And this has never been done in the South. And often in the United States, corruption is a word you use when people are using the government to do something that they haven't done before, yes, or something they don't, you don't want them to do with, yeah, it. So it may not be corruption so much as it is, you know, this sort of consistent anti-tax small government focus. And so a lot of the discussion of Reconstruction really does center on those kinds of things.
Yeah, the 14th and 15th Amendments come out of this legislation.
Absolutely, they? Absolutely. And there's really a redefinition of national citizenship, although it takes a while for it to stick.
So besides the fire and the wedge, you use the metaphor of the telephone exchange to help organize the period that you talk about here. And this seems to be where the optimism of your book really comes into play. For one thing, this part of the story is in part about stores and shopping and the rise of consumer culture, which I know isn't wholly a positive thing in the way it played out, but does have positive elements.
It does, and it was certainly one of the more fun things to write about in the book, the sort of rise of a more commercialized Christmas and the department store and mail order catalogs and things of that sort are an awful lot of fun to write about.
It's also the telephone exchange about other kinds of communication, including cultural vehicles such as Joseph Rice's photographic book, How the Other Half Lives, and yellow journalism aside. It's through the arts that there often did seem to arise certain important counters to the destructive aspects of 19th century American society. For one, they can be used to stimulate conscience as well as debate and negotiations.
One I really wanted to get at with the telephone exchange was that sense that Americans' identities are changing in different ways. For example, one of the things that comes out of this period by the early 20th century is some people begin to identify themselves as fundamentalists, mm-hmm, in religion. And that's not even a term that would have made sense 40 years earlier, because the issues that are emerging in religion and concurrently in science and in scientific research just aren't the same in 1910 that they were in 1870. And the same thing about people identifying themselves according to their sexual orientation or identifying themselves as environmentalists or in many other ways, these sort of new identities emerge in this period, and the telephone exchange seemed to me a kind of nice example, yeah, of how that happens. Through mass market magazines, people are able to create sort of, you know, a whole new community of people who are bicycling enthusiasts, mm-hmm, and all over the country, people who are bicycling enthusiasts take the same magazines, and that sort of thing is new.
Yeah, identity to some extent here, advertising plays into this, and advertising on a massive scale in a way.
Absolutely,
absolutely. And I wonder about the ways in which consumer culture, particularly with the vehicle of advertising at its disposal, and the arts are related as products of the imagination. And you mentioned in passing that Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, was a window display dresser in Chicago.
And yes, in fact, he was the editor of a national journal called Display Window Professional or something
I
can't remember what it's called, but he was a major thinker about how you could use display windows in new ways for advertising and for sales. One of the things that emerges in this period is this idea, capitalism is not going to work if people only buy what they need. The point is to get them to buy things they don't need, but that they want. And so that advertising and all the allied sort of new professional arts that go along with that, and all the exuberance of consumer culture, because it's certainly not much fun to go out and buy only what you need, right?
No.
I mean, we probably all need two shirts, right? No. So one of them can be washed and we can wear the other one. But this is the era of that kind of exuberant corporate capitalism and consumer culture. It really begins emerging in the 1880s, I think.
Yeah, it does address our desire to reconstruct our own identities.
There's a soap advertisement that says not, how does it go? It's not that smart mothers choose a particular kind of soap, but instead this is the choice of smart mothers. Uh-huh. So it becomes part of your persona. Rather than just choosing something that's going to make you cleaner, you're sort of transforming your identity by choosing the hippest or the smartest product.
And you could understand Baum's Emerald City as a kind of Wanamaker's with all its departments for helping you to find this new identity. And in the film, as I remember it, there were those wonderful scenes with manicurists, the hairstylists, and the profusion of glittering new things everywhere.
The book that I drew on for that, and all of this is based on, you know, really a sort of synthesis of other historians' work. William Leach has a great book called Land of Desire, and he just has a wonderful section about Baum and Baum's vision of this kind of consumer paradise.
The con man figure in the book, the wizard himself, is interesting also. And as we mentioned, Mark Twain had already constructed this figure as the archetypal American,
yes,
the con man. But Baum seems to have a soft spot for this figure in a sense. He's not a sinister figure at all.
He does. He, I think, thinks of the wizard maybe in terms of advertising,
yeah,
and things of that,
yeah,
sort. There's another whole reading of The Wizard of Oz that says that it's a kind of populist fable and that Dorothy represents the populace of Kansas and that the Tin Man is the labor and the Scarecrow is the farmer and that the lion is William Jennings Bryan. And there's actually kind of, I mean, there's a whole bunch of very persuasive literature out there on that too. I'm not sure it's either or. I wonder if Baum, yeah, didn't sort of capture both. As a good salesman, he would have wanted to, you know, pitch his novel both to people who are in the cities and also on the farm. So,
now also subsumed in this metaphor of the exchange is community development, which you mentioned, say, with the bicyclists and the populist movement, including the rise of labor organizations and social activism in general. And one of those movements you talk about, kind of spontaneous movement, is Coxey's Army, which I thought was a fascinating story.
It's one of my favorite all-time episodes in American history. I've always wanted to write a little document collection on the March of Coxey's Army, which was called The Commonweal of Christ. And there's some really interesting characters associated with this movement,
Hogan,
too. Hogan, Carl Brown, who was an associate of Jacob Coxey, who was the leader of the movement. And Carl Brown was deeply pathologically anti-Semitic, and he also was very religiously unconventional, like I should say. He had sat at the bedside of his dying wife, and he believed that her soul had entered his body when she died, so that he was carrying her soul and his. So in addition to the march itself, which is one of the greatest examples of sort of the origins of the New Deal, because these are people saying, look, there's a terrible depression, the federal government should hire us to improve the nation's roads, and there should be direct employment in order for people not to starve.
And these people all marched on Washington.
And they marched on Washington.
March on Washington.
That's right. They marched on Washington to ask for this. And Coxey, when they got there, was arrested for trespassing on the Capitol grass. There's a nice story about that. He was invited 25 years later, more than that, 30 years later, on the 30th anniversary of Coxey's March, I think, he came to Washington amidst the New Deal and read the statement that he had originally, you know, had sought to read in the 1890s. In the midst of the federal government doing all the things that the Coxey's Army folks had envisioned them doing in the 1890s, but it had been much too radical then.
Yes, that's a perfect example of what you were saying earlier about progressive impulses of the 1890s finding their fruit only much later.
Yes.
Hogan, I know, is still a popular folk hero in Montana.
Really?
Yeah.
Hogan's Ride is quite a story.
Well, somebody should make a movie of it. You know?
I agree, actually. I think someone should write a screenplay about
commandeered a train.
Yes.
He and 400 of his followers, and because it was from Montana, it was a long walk to Washington.
Yes, and all the people in Butte, I think is where they started from, and all the people in Butte packed the train with sandwiches and food and brought them supplies. Then they said, clear the track, we're headed east. And they got, I think they got 400 miles or so,
yeah,
before the U.S. Marshals came out and stopped them.
People helped them all along the way. They fed them and sabotaged their pursuers.
Yes, yes. It's a very interesting thing. I think a lot of the people, when Coxey's Army marched through, a lot of towns got together and they sort of said, well, what we should do is help these people on their way really quickly, right?
Yes.
And some people were genuinely supportive and others sort of said, 1,000 men who are unemployed and need something to eat.
Yeah.
Let's feed them lunch, and that'll give them the energy to march to the next town. And a lot of people really didn't want to deal with
but
this.
But on the whole, they were very well disciplined.
They were.
They were
they
like
were.
Napoleon's army going through Russia. They were.
That's right. And they took pride on being peaceable and on not stealing and on. They actually had no women marching with them because the leaders thought that that could be complicating.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to be very clear in their goals.
And the telephone exchange, of course, is manned by women. And many of the progressive organizations and movements of the period were the product of initiatives and much hard and sometimes dangerous work by women. It seems women were a motive force in American politics, both inside and outside traditional party structures, long before they got the vote.
Yes, I think they were. And that really starts in the 1850s, I think, although there are some women invited to political meetings before that and waving their handkerchiefs. But women start stump speaking in the 1850s and really during the Civil War. And in a broader sense, I think it's, you know, really the U.S. emerges from the Civil War with women doing all these different public things. Working during the Civil War, women begin working for the federal government as treasury clerks for the first time, and women enter all kinds of different paid professions. And so you have this huge revolution. Women who had grown up in the 1850s watched their daughters graduate from high school, graduate from places like Vassar, and watched them take jobs and have independent careers and create settlement houses and things of that sort. And there's a huge flourishing of women's public role.
And a lot of 20th century social organizations, social welfare organizations, seem to come out of 19th century women's movements.
Absolutely, and out of women's training in fields like social work, which are emerging fields that are really very welcoming to women. Women's work as teachers and in the education system. So I think it all kind of builds over the course of the late 19th century.
So one last question. When you regard yourself as a teacher, do you think of yourself as participating in an historical project that goes back to this period? In other words, that you're carrying on the work of progressives who have gone before you, that you're, so to speak, a kind of switchboard operator yourself, trying to make sure that the past gets properly connected to whomever is waiting at the other end of the line.
I think I probably do. We were just discussing in one of my classes, there's this great quote from the journalist Tom Wicker, and he says he thinks that Americans are innocent of history. It's not that they're ignorant of history. It's not that they just didn't sort of take the class in school. It's that we're such a forward-looking nation, which often serves us very well. I mean, you don't want to be like the Serbs and Croats sitting around debating the Battle of Kosovo like 800 years later.
Or the Civil War, right?
You really, I mean, that refreshing, forward-looking, progressive, optimistic vision has always been part of Americans' identity. And a lot of immigrants came here to have things different than they were at home. And a lot of people picked up stakes and moved west or changed their names or all these things, these ways of reshaping yourself. But we lose a lot with that. And I think one of the goals of history is to really connect people to the past, because I think Americans are really almost uniquely in the world, not very well connected to our past. We don't think about it. I guess it's in America that the slang is, you know, oh, that's he's history, right? Meaning, you know,
that's not something you really want to pay attention to.
If it's past, it doesn't matter anymore. You just sort of erase it.
Well, certainly one of the great satisfactions of reading history is that it can make you more sure-footed, so to speak, about traversing your own time by extending your own vista and view of the landscape.
I think I also like history because it gives you a little bit of a sense of distance, and maybe that's hopeful. You know, maybe in the midst of catastrophe or in the midst of a really, really horrible moment, you could think, well, things used to be even worse, or things sometimes take a long time to change. We were just reading a quote in my House Divided class from the English socialist William Morris, who said that history is really in some ways about how men fight and lose the battle, and what they fought for comes about despite their defeat, but that when it comes about, it turns out not to be what they meant, and other men have to fight for what they meant under another name. So I think that some of history is also about getting that sense of irony and also a sense of perspective, so that if you lose a congressional election or you can't get a bill passed or, you know, you're frustrated with a problem, you have some sense of being part of longer or larger historical processes.
You have a nice image that you end the book with of Henry James sitting in a movie theater. Is it a movie theater?
I think it's a Bowery Theater in New York. Although there were movie theaters by then.
Eating Whitman samplers and wondering if the America that he's come back to is at all the same as the America he left.
Yes. I co-taught with my colleague Wendy Graham in English right about the time I was working on this book, and she introduced me to Henry James's The American Scene, which is just a wonderful book that I didn't know. And he has this great section where he's been over in Italy looking at all the great monuments of Italian civilization. And he said, hey, why are these Italian immigrants moving here when I was there looking at the... And then he said, well, maybe they came here for the standard of living. And then he sort of meditates on how good America is at producing cheap chocolates. And he sort of says, maybe that's what our culture or our civilization is that this is what we do really, really well. And it's a kind of wonderful little irony, I think.
Yeah, true. Another thing, though, that history can teach you is to remind you where the sugar for those chocolates came from and what it cost.
That's right. It struck me at a very late point in writing the book that sugar actually worked really well as the kind of central metaphor to end the book.
That's
so
like
I don't know about
oil,
starting with
it?
Fire and ending with sugar, but you know, it was, I mean, all the new imperial possessions of the United States were producing sugar, and American sugar consumption at home was going up, 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 and people were enjoying all these confections, and it seemed to me that sugar made just a kind of wonderful end point to think about its role in the economy and society. And
it was a nice image. So I want to thank you, Rebecca, for visiting us on the Library Cafe.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Yeah, it was delightful. We've been talking with Rebecca Edwards on the Library Cafe about her new book, New Spirits, Americans in the Gilded Age, published this year by Oxford University Press. If you tuned in late, you can hear a podcast of this interview at library-cafe.org.